Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations About Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations, discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Crisis Response Services Program Manager, Andrea Nunes Gardner, ADAPT Supervisor, Jennifer Perkins, and Domestic and Sexual Violence Counselor, Lisa Grote, to define common interpersonal violence terms. Andrea, Jen, Lisa, welcome to Unscripted, and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having you.
Well, of course, the gang's all here. Before we get started, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. Folks who work in the interpersonal violence field throw around words and phrases like trauma bonding, emotional regulation, and rape culture every day. We think these are self-explanatory, but if the people we support don't fully understand what we mean when we use these terms, or if they themselves are using them incorrectly, are we doing them a disservice? On today's episode of Unscripted, we will define some of these common terms. So let's start with healthy relationships, because as we discuss these terms, we might mention healthy relationships, and so we should have a quick definition. Andrea, I'll let you define this one.
Yeah, so healthy relationships, you know, there is a combination of things that are included. Having open communication, respecting boundaries, having equality in partnership, having independence and support, and just, you know, even as we often talk about conflict in relationships, it's almost like, feels like, well, it's not good to have conflict, but actually constructive conflict resolution is very important in healthy relationships. So healthy relationships is always, you know, fostering growth and balance, having emotional connection, respecting autonomy, you know, and just empower individuals to being individuals, right? Like having their own life within the relationship that is not just like, you know, we're going to talk about like some of the terms like love bombing. And I'm like really excited to, you know, dive in on those terms, but just, you know, keeping in mind that, you know, in healthy relationships, individuals can thrive separately, but also together.
Okay. And since you mentioned love bombing, I'm going to let you continue and define this. What is love bombing?
Well, it sounds almost like, you know, oh, it's not that bad, like being love bombed, right? Like someone that, you know, shows like a lot of attention, a lot of affection, but that usually happens very, very quickly. Right? It's not like in a healthy relationship that those things happen steadily. In love bombing, it's very quickly, right? Like, and so it can be a red flag and for an unhealthy relationship when there is like too much too soon. And so oftentimes people think, well, but that is romantic, right? Like, so I'll give an example. I just met someone. And, you know, like the next day they're sending gifts, they're sending flowers. And then they're like, I really want to see you today. You know, like I couldn't stop thinking about you. And you say, well, I can't today because I already have plans with my friend. Right. And this person may just show up at your house and wait for you, with flowers. Right. And you're like, oh, I didn't know that you were going to be here. They're like, well, I really just want to see you. I just miss you. Just want to bring some flowers, right? Like, and it might seem like, oh, that's so romantic and so caring, but that is also really creepy that someone is just not respecting your boundaries and just coming to your house. So I think that there is, you know, that balance of like when you first meet someone that you have that opportunity to get to know them, to get to, experience, you know, a lot of things together before that it jumps like to all this at once. You know, it's like, in healthy relationships, we are not like just jumping to like showing a lot of affection all at once. It's more gradual.
Yeah, I didn't know the term love bombing. I didn't know that it existed. I didn't know what this was. But I dated a guy who sprinkled rose petals on my steps, all the way up my steps into the main level of my house, and, you know, told me he couldn't live without me. He was buying me jewelry, and it felt creepy because it happened within the first 8 days of meeting me. But I didn't even know there was a term for this at the time. So,
yeah, and I think it's important to also understand that this can kind of behavior can lead to abusive behaviors, to control, to manipulation. So it is like something to be aware that can be a red flag.
Jen, I'm going to let you respond to this as well, because on a previous episode of Unscripted in another season, you gave a spot on definition of what love bombing is. I'm going to let you tell everybody what that definition was.
Oh, love on steroids?
Yeah.
And I was thinking in the LGBTQIA plus community, we also have a term for it called U-hauling.
Mm-hmm.
Moving real fast, real quick, really intense at the beginning. And it could be really confusing because some of your friends can see that person showing up with flowers outside and be like, oh, that is so sweet. That is so romantic. You are so lucky. And so you might, even though your gut might say like, this is creepy or this is weird, then when you hear those messages, you're like, oh, I should be really grateful and happy that this is happening. You know, people are like, wow, what a gentleman, you know, or what a amazing, how romantic this person is. So it could be really confusing at first, and it could be hard to not see it for what it is, which is really a form of psychological manipulation. It's really about the intention. What is the intention of these gestures? So really, you have to look at that to see, like, what is behind these big grand gestures of rose petals up the stairs and showing up with flowers to my friend get together. You know, what is the intention behind it?
Okay. Jen, I'm going to stay with you. Gaslighting. I hear this thrown around a lot by people not in the business, by general public. It seems like it's a trendy definition to use right now. But what is gaslighting?
So gaslighting is another form of psychological manipulation where somebody makes you question your own reality. And it can be done in so many different ways. Some is less obvious than others. So let's just take the example that we just gave with the person showing up with the flowers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Say I'm the person that they're dating, and I'm with my friends, tell them I'm busy with my friends. They show up outside with flowers and it doesn't feel right to me. I feel, you know, like what Andrea mentioned, like my boundaries have been violated. It feels kind of creepy to me. And they decide to speak to them about it and say, you know, I'm a little confused why you showed up. I told you I was spending time with my friends. And their reaction is like, well, I don't understand. So many women would love to have someone they're dating show up with flowers. Like, I thought you would be grateful. And all of a sudden I'm like, ooh, did I say the wrong thing? Like, maybe I'm being ungrateful. Like, maybe, I feel bad now. Right. So all of a sudden the script is flipped where before it was me coming to you with a concern about something that you did that didn't feel good to me. And the consequence, which is like the gaslighting, is that now I am questioning my reaction and my feeling. And when that happens repeatedly, all of a sudden I start to question my reaction, question that gut feeling. Maybe I am overreacting. Maybe I'm being ungrateful. And this shows up in so many ways. And it could show up in non-romantic relationships too. It could be anybody you're in a relationship with, that person who I think a lot of us have experienced when somebody says a joke and we're like, ooh, that didn't feel good. That wasn't funny and that kind of hurt. And you see something and they're like, gosh, what's wrong? Can't you take a joke?
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are really, really common. And sometimes can feel like very subtle ways that people can flip the script on us and have us start to question our own reaction. And when it's done over and over repeatedly, especially in a close romantic relationship or other attachment relationship, all of a sudden, you lose trust in yourself in that relationship. You might become more dependent on that other person to really gauge how you should and shouldn't feel about things versus coming from within yourself. So All of a sudden, I'm giving this person a lot of power and control over my emotional well-being and my emotional state and my own self-esteem, my own feelings of value and self-confidence and competency is all of a sudden withered away, because now all of a sudden I don't trust that I have the ability to make good decisions or trust how I feel.
Lisa, I'm coming to you next. Trauma bonding. What is this?
So it's something we see a lot of in counseling. So it's not what it sounds like. It's not two people who've experienced trauma bonding over their shared experiences. What it is it's a strong bond that's really hard to break, that's created by the ups and downs of an abusive relationship. So it's very rare that a relationship starts where it's abuse, just abuse from the beginning. Almost always we see like the love bombing, like Andrea described. So they fall in love with a person who they believe to be kind, you know, caring, all these things. And then when the abuse starts, like they get confused and they're like, oh, and it alternates between these two. Like we hear about dual personalities, like Jekyll and Hyde. Sometimes people think they have bipolar disorder, but it's not actually that. It's that, you know, two faces of the person in an abusive relationship. So it's the mixture of positive reinforcement, so moments of kindness and affection, and the abuse, whether it's verbal, physical, sexual. And so it keeps you trapped in the relationship, really, because you're constantly off guard, not knowing which person's going to show up. And you're waiting for that good person that you fell in love with to come back. And because it's often like an overt manipulation tactic that they will give you just a little, like crumbs of kindness, to keep you, you know, in the relationship. And so you do get the hope. Oh, see, yeah, that's the man or woman I fell in love with. And so you stay in the relationship because you always have the hope that that person's going to come back. They've tested this actually with animals, like with mice, where if they press a lever and they get food, you would think that if they always, every time they press the lever, they get the food, that would make them press the lever the most. But no, it's actually the mice that sometimes when they press the lever, they get food. And sometimes when they press the lever, they don't get food. That intermittent reinforcement that keeps them pressing the lever. Like it's almost like an addiction to a drug. So I think that's one of the, when people ask, which is victim blaming, which we'll define later, you know, why do they stay instead of asking why is the person abusing them? Trauma bonding is one of the many reasons that people do stay, is that psychological phenomenon.
It sounds a little bit like Stockholm syndrome. Is that the same thing?
It is. It's very similar to Stockholm syndrome. Stockholm syndrome comes from a hostage situation where trauma bonding is more often used with, you know, interpersonal relationships rather than that was a stranger in that case. But it is where you come to identify with and, you know, care for an abusive person. So,
okay. Rape culture. Andrea, I'm going to give this one to you.
Well, let me tell you, I have lots of thoughts about it, but, you know, just trying to define the term before I go on my soapbox. It refers to, you know, environments that normalize or excuse sexual violence, and that includes rape, harassment. So rape culture really, you know, includes what Lisa was just talking about, victim blaming, right? Like, so when we say, you know, when someone tells a survivor tells their story, we, you know, immediately ask, but what were they eating? What are they drinking when that happens? Or, you know, were they drinking? What were they wearing? And so there is a lot of like, you know, victim blaming. So that's part of rape culture, objectification of women, jokes about rape, right? Like, so there is a lot of things that contribute like to that rape culture and diminish the significance and the importance and in how serious rape and sexual violence is. And oftentimes can even discourage survivors from speaking out, right? Because then it's like, well, I'm not going to talk about it because then I'm going to have all this, you know, belief coming towards me, right? Like, or all this questioning. And so people might not even wanting to share their experience. I also have seen a lot, you know, in terms of like language changing, you know, rape to grape. So we don't talk about rape because the algorithm will suppress my content, right? Like, so even, you know, like there is a suppression of content when people speak about rape. And so people have to create different words just to be able to talk about or talk about their experience or even tell a story about rape in a social media platform. So, you know, rape culture really goes beyond that. It's just like, oh, this is just normalizing or excuse sexual violence, but it has like a very big impact for survivors of sexual violence.
I would like to add, too, that we have a lot of popular movies, and I know we did a podcast episode on this not too long ago that really romanticizes this male character who's really in control to a submissive female, like the Twilight series, the 50 Shades of Grey series. And then if you look at pornography also really plays a role in rape culture. I mean, a lot of pornography shows men strangling women, pulling their hair, making it look like this is something women enjoy. And so you have all these media sources giving, especially young people, but people of all ages, this idea that women like men who are in control of them and their bodies. And this is something that's romantic. And this is what women want from men. That certainly adds to rape culture as well.
Right. And how we also address, you know, cases of rape, when the message that we receive is, you know, wow, this person has a whole career ahead of them. Let's not, you know, punish them in a way that can interfere with their career, right? Like they have all this to look for. And so we're just going to give them, like, you know, the slap on the wrist and, you know, let's not make this silly mistake being define who they are, right? Like, and so there is also that reinforcement. There is, you know, not really taking consideration. We have people that have been, you know, confirmed to office that have raped women, that have sexual assault women. And we just like, well, that is not that important. You know, like there was other things that are more important about this person. Like this was just a mistake. So that is part of rape culture as well,
which also determines how the victim moves forward. You know, some folks have been raped and it's so awful and so life-changing that for the rest of their life they're living with the results of this attack on them, while the person who committed the crime goes on to a normal life.
And in my experience, you know, as a therapist, I have heard like so many reports of people disclosing, you know, their experience to family and hearing like, oh my gosh, why are you doing this to this person? Why are you making such a big deal? Let it go. Like it's been a long time ago, right? Like, and so there is also this, like, you know, shame on the victim for even talking about it. And like, and they are responsible for me. Like they are making this bad, right? Like they are making this sound so bad. So I think that is also something that I hear often that prevents victims like to, you know, healing because there is no validation of their experience. You know, there is a lot of like, you know, minimizing their experience and making them like feel like, oh, you shouldn't be feeling this way. This is a long time ago. Get over it.
Okay. This sounds like we could actually do a whole episode on rape culture, but we don't have time for that.
Definitely
today.
Could, yes.
But yep. We will do some definitions about sexual assault versus rape. So I'll tackle this one because I recently did an article about the difference between the two. Sexual assault is when someone forces or tries to force another person to take part in sexual activities without their consent. This can include touching private parts, kissing, or more serious acts like rape. Rape is a very serious form of sexual assault where someone forces another person to have sex without their permission. It's a crime that can have long-lasting effects on the victim, as you just mentioned, Andrea. It also appears that it depends on which state you live in as to which term is applied, when legally and law enforcement-wise. So, we tackled that one. You mentioned strangulation and choking. So, Jen, you mentioned it, so I'm gonna let you tackle that. What's the difference between choking and strangulation?
The way that it was explained to me that made the most sense is you choke on a piece of food.
Mm-hmm.
So strangulation is when somebody restricts your airway so you're not able to breathe, which is not the same as choking on a piece of food.
Okay.
That's okay. How it's been explained to me.
Okay.
But they are often used, like choking is often used when strangulation is what's meant. I've heard from law enforcement, from even people in the field, it's commonly used to mean strangulation.
And yes, one of the things that I've heard is that if you ask someone, have they been strangled, they may not know what you're talking about because they think choking is strangulation. So.
And the term choking is also using, you know, in terms of like sexual pleasure, you know, people, you use that term of choking and like Jen said, that is very common out in porn, right? Like, and so people might not recognize, you know, and we can also do a whole episode about choking and strangulation during sex, and the dangers of it. Like we could like spend a long time talking about, but I think that also people use that term a lot more. And, you know, in the lethality assessment protocol, we used to ask that question, you know, using the word choke, and yeah. Because people recognize that more, but also there is a downside because when you're using interpretation or when you're translating, that might not translate for what we're looking for. So you don't get what you're, you know, the intention of the question loses its meaning. But like Lisa said, people will, you know, use those two terms like often, like, you know, meaning the same thing.
Interchangeably, yeah.
Okay. Financial abuse, which is a form of domestic violence. And it seems like it's exactly what the term says. But I added it to the list because I don't think we include all the behaviors that are financial abuse. Like when I think financial abuse, I think somebody running up your credit card. But what else could financial abuse look like?
So many things, and sometimes opposite things. So it can be not allowing someone to work. It can also be forcing someone to work and making them turn over their money to you. It can be taking out a loan, using someone's social security number without their permission, getting credit cards. It can be excluding someone from financial decision making when you're married and, you know, community property states, like making all the financial decisions without the other person's input. It can also be things like even after separation, it can continue. People scaring someone into say, I'm going to declare the children as my dependents, even though they're not paying their child support, but they intimidate the other person. So it can take very many forms.
Okay. Narcissist, or as I hear a lot, toxic narcissist. And I'm hearing that this a lot in the general public as well right now. But they're using the term incorrectly. So what exactly is a narcissist? Andrea, I'm going to let you handle this one.
Well, I think that, yes, people do use narcissists a lot, right? Like, and there's a difference between having narcissist traits, which is like someone that has a really high sense of self-importance. They don't have as much empathy for others. They need admiration. They are also very charming. And so, you know, maybe when they are in public with you, they are like doubting on you and making, you know, like your friends think, wow, your partner is amazing, you know, like he's so caring and so loving. But behind closed doors, that's not like how it looks like, right? Like it could look like someone, you know, expressing feelings or expressing concerns. And the person that has that narcissist trait, you know, shifting the conversation to themselves or, you know, claiming that that person is being too sensitive or, you know, really minimizing what the other person is saying or overly criticize the person. And so there is like a lot of things that could include on that narcissist trait, which is different than having narcissistic personality disorder, which it is a diagnosis on DSM-5, right? Like, so I think it's important, like, to also make that distinction because people make, like, the claims, like, oh, this person is narcissistic, right? Like, meaning, like, that they have a personality disorder. But, you know, like, that might be just, like, some trait that they define as narcissist. So, like, when we are talking about narcissists, we're talking about someone that is very manipulative, controlling, that, you know, has that sense of superiority, and used other people to fulfill their emotional needs, and they might use their partner and their partner's well-being to fulfill their emotional needs.
We're going to pause here quickly to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. We have mentioned victim blaming several times over the course of this episode. So now we're going to actually get to a real definition. Jen, I'm going to let you take this one. What is victim blaming?
Victim blaming is exactly what it sounds like. It's blaming a victim for the harm that was caused onto them. So Andrea gave a very common example of what this looks like. Often with sexual violence, when somebody's been the victim of sexual violence, we ask, what were they doing out that late by themselves? What were they wearing? Were they under the influence? Right? All these reasons we're looking to fault them for something that is not their fault, for something that someone else did to them. And we see this with domestic violence too. We saw this a lot in the Diddy trial with Cassie Ventura, where people were like, why didn't she leave? Why did she stay? Why did she send him such nice text messages every now and then if he was such a monster, right? So it's, again, putting blame and fault with the person who was harmed versus holding the person who did the harm accountable and finding excuses for behavior that's just not excusable.
Okay. About a year ago, I got into a heated debate with somebody who believes herself an ally and said several times during our conversation that she's an ally. But then she kept saying things like, a woman knows when her partner is being abusive, so she's partly to blame if she stays. That's classic victim blaming. And when I said that that's what she was doing, she got really mad at me, and we haven't talked since. So I just, it's not always, you know, the court systems or the person who's causing the harm that's blaming victims, but it could be somebody who thinks they're an ally.
And I think alcohol is a classic example of it, that if the victim is intoxicated when they're sexually assaulted, somehow that makes them more responsible. But if the person who is sexually assaulting them is intoxicated, somehow that makes them less responsible. So the very same thing, being intoxicated, makes the victim more guilty and the person who's sexually assaulting them less. So it just shows the hypocrisy of, again, rape culture.
Yes. Okay, we're going to move on to emotional regulation. Andrea, I'm going to let you answer, but Jen, I also want you to answer after Andrea, because emotional regulation, apparently you guys do a lot of it in ADAPT.
Correct.
Okay, so Andrea, I'm going to you first. What is emotional regulation?
No, is it what it sounds, right? Is regulating your emotions. And so I think it's important to define what an emotion is. So an emotion, it is a physical response, right? Like your body responds physically to a situation. So if I am really sad, my emotional response might be crying. My emotional response might be shutting down, right? Like those are all emotional response. So emotional regulation is the ability of regulating that emotion, right? Like, so there are many different ways of doing that. So taking deep breaths and being able like to come back to your baseline, right? Like, so when we are having an emotional response, our brain is just, you know, thinking from our emotional brain is like our amygdala, which is responsible for regulating our emotions, is very activated. And so the part of our brain that, you know, like make decisions and impulse control kind of like goes offline. And so we are a complete, like, we're just like emotional response. We see that a lot in little kids, right? Like when they throw a tantrum and you might attempt like to reason with them and you are not going to get anywhere because, you know, the issue is not, they are not online when it comes like to their rational brain. Their emotional brain is talking, right? Like, and so regulating your emotions is that ability of like coming back to baseline, coming back to a place of like calm and where your rational brain is back online and is able like to respond and able to have a conversation and actually talking through the issues. So in relationships, emotional regulation is extremely important, and that, you know, one of the reasons that in ADAPT this is like one of the core things in the curriculum. So I'll let Jen talk a little bit more about how they applied it in ADAPT.
Yeah, so I mean, most people, believe it or not, who cause harm to their loved ones and engage in domestic violence do not wake up in the morning and say, "I am going to terrorize my family today." It's a lot of carrying around a lot of emotions and reacting and being on autopilot and not even being in touch and aware of what they're feeling or why they're feeling the way they are. And so we do a lot of work with starting to be able to learn language to describe how we're feeling, understand why we're feeling, when we're feeling these different emotions, where are they coming from? And a lot of almost like mindfulness work of stopping, pausing before we just react to these strong, intense emotions, especially when they're negative emotions. So it's a lot of work of like starting to recognize when my body is feeling angry, irritable, agitated, impatient, all those yucky feelings, and being able to be more connected to those body feelings, those physical feelings, and then being able to work through those feelings. So we're responding to what's going on in our environment versus reacting to what's going on, especially when things are not going our way.
And I realize we use the term ADAPT a lot, which is an acronym, and that people may not know what that is. So Jen, what is the ADAPT program? What is ADAPT program for?
This is putting me on the spot. This is a long one. Okay, anger and domestic abuse prevention and treatment.
Okay. Another buzzword this decade, trauma-informed. Everybody is trauma-informed. Everything we do is through a trauma-informed lens. But what is trauma-informed in layman's terms, Andrea? I'm going to give this one to you.
Yeah, so we do use that a lot. And it's a very clinical term and word, just to say, you know, that we recognize that every person's, you know, trauma, every survivor experience is unique. And from a trauma-informed approach, the goal is to create an environment that, you know, really allow for healing and respect people's autonomy, right? Like, and so in domestic violence, oftentimes, you know, we just talk about like the idea of leaving, right? Like, why don't this person leave, right? Like, and so in a trauma-informed approach, we don't ask those questions, right? Because we do believe that the survivor knows what's best for them. They know, like, they are the experts, right? Like, in their life. And so is therapist, is an advocate. We are actually there just to support and collaborate in helping people get to safety, right? And not like imposing what I think it's safe or imposing, you know, what I think that this person should do, but actually is honoring their autonomy and comes through from a very much like understanding the impact of trauma and also not re-traumatizing people, right? Like, so, they are not telling their story, for example, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going through the system. Like, so they first disclose to their therapist and then they go to, they might disclose to the police and then they have to, again, to disclose to the shelter, you know, so being trauma informed is minimizing also the amount of times that this person needs to tell their story and not re-traumatizing them, not just by, you know, telling their story, but also with things that, with the terms that we talk about, rape culture, right? Like a victim blaming, asking them questions like, but what were you wearing? What did you expect would happen if you stay in an abusive relationship, right? Like that is not trauma-informed.
Jen, briefly, what is sexual coercion?
Sexual coercion is any sort of sexual encounter, exchange, behavior where the person doesn't feel that they can say no without certain consequences. So I'll give some examples. I mean, we already had discussed about sexual assault and rape. Sexual coercion sometimes can look different. And I hear this particularly, this conversation come up a lot in when I hear other women talking about their intimate, physical intimate relationships with their male partners. Like, well, if I say no, he's going to find it elsewhere. He's going to be mad at me. It's my wifely duty to say yes. You know, he has been really helpful with the children, so I owe him. It's this dynamics that can occur in a relationship where there's a sexual relationship where one person doesn't feel like they could say no without there being some sort of consequence. And the consequence might be the silent treatment. The consequence might be, guilt, blame, feeling bad, somebody making feel really bad, like you're not putting in your share of the relationship by not doing this one thing for me. So it could be a little bit less of a subtle, although sometimes not so subtle, dynamic that occurs, an abusive dynamic in terms of a sexual relationship compared to maybe more what we think of as violent sexual assaults, such as rape that we talked about.
Okay, and then the last one today, safety planning. It's another one that sounds really simple, but it's kind of nuanced. So Lisa, I'm going to let you handle this one.
Sure. So safety planning in domestic violence context has to do with doing what you can. Like there, you can never guarantee the safety of a person in an abusive relationship, but doing what you can to, you know, increase safety for that person. And one misconception is that safety plan is always to help someone leave a relationship safely. But actually, you know, part of being trauma-informed is following the person's lead. Some people don't want to leave an abusive relationship. So it can be, how can you stay as safe as possible while you're in this relationship? And another thing, another misconception about safety planning is that it's only about physical safety. Safety planning can also be financial safety. It can also be emotional safety. For example, having support. So if you're getting verbally abused every day, having people in your life who are going to remind you of what a wonderful person you are, having, if it's safe to do so, you know, outside activities that make you feel good about yourself, where you can, you know, feel confident in yourself. But it can be physical safety too. It can be things like having a code word, for example, that will alert, you know, someone that if, for example, if you're on the phone with it, you can say that you're the person who's going to hurt you won't know, but it tells that person you need to call the police or tells your kids, okay, go to your room, you know, and, you know, call 911 or don't come out. Yeah, I could go there. Safety planning could also be a whole episode. There are a lot of different things that you can do to increase your safety. And we're a place to come to if you're in need of that.
Okay. We may at some point need to do another round of terms that we throw around that everybody doesn't necessarily understand. Today, we're not doing that, though. This is going to do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Andrea, Jen, and Lisa for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.